Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder and today we're going to do Francis Parker Yaki's The Enemy of Europe. We're going to do the second of four sections as we're dividing these sessions. This is a section called The Metapolitics of the War. It's fairly short, goes from page 24 to 35, has three chapters. The three aspects of the war, results of the war, and power problems of the war. And as I say, this is the second of the four sections. It's not us breaking into. He has this book of some 90 plus pages broken into these four sections. So this one happens to be a lot shorter than the stuff we've been doing the last few sessions. So we'll just keep it like that, though. And you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Now let's get into it. The Metapolitics of the War is the name of this section. The first section was the morphology of the Second World War. This is the metapolitics of the war with three chapters. The first chapter is the three aspects of the war. In this age of absolute politics, culture provides the motivation for great wars. From 1000 to 1500 AD, the inner politics of Europe was determined by fealty. The motivation for the intra-European power struggles during the centuries up to the Congress of Vienna, that's in 1815, was religious and dynastic. During the 19th century, it was nationalistic and economic. After 1900, the whole planet became increasingly active politically. The decline of England's power awakened in the colored world the illusion that the entire Western culture found itself in a state of decreasing power. That was false indeed, but the outbreak of the First World War and the worldwide verdict against Western power and Western prestige seemed to confirm this misconception. Since the scale of political activity has become planetary, only two spiritual possibilities for a conflict remain. First, the Western idea of world rule, and for over two centuries, directly or indirectly, the West actually did rule the greater part of the world. And second, the outer revolt, which is simply the negation of this Western idea. Manifestation of the Western world empire were the British Empire and all other European overseas empires, the Americans' conquest of their continent, American imperialism in the Pacific, Germany's enduring desire for expansion into the Slavic areas, and its pushing back of the eastern frontier of the Western culture during the millennium 1000 to 2000, manifestations of the outer revolt were the Chinese Opium War against England, the Indian mutinies of 1857 and 1947, the Zulu Wars, the Mexican Revolt against Maximilian, the Mexican Revolution of 1910, the Chinese Revolution of 1911, the Philippine insurrections against Spain, and the latter Philippine uprisings against America, 1900 to 1946, the Bolshevist Revolution of 1917, the Japanese War against the West, 1941 to 45. Thus, the power front is seen to be based on culture as the dominant spiritual front in world politics, and all other politics, be it primitive, local, or personal, is overshadowed by this tremendous disjunction. On the planet, there is only one high culture in the process of fulfillment, the Western culture. Outside of that culture, there are only the remnants of dead cultures whose peoples have once again become primitive, fellahin, like the Chinese, Hindu, and Islamic savages, like the African and American Aborigines, barbarians, like the Russians and certain tribes in Central Asia. All peoples living outside the West have perforce taken over many Western customs and characteristics since the uniquely powerful imperialism of the West lays claim to the whole earth. And its performance has forced the people of the world to acknowledge the undeniable intellectual and material superiority of Europe. This does not mean, however, that Westernization can ever be anything other than superficial. When the Western culture says yes to its imperialistic urge, it naturally calls forth a reaction among those who do not belong to it. Their organic response is an equally passionate no. When they take up Western methods, it is only to use them against the West. If spears cannot defeat whites, let us learn how to build factories and produce machines. From a cultural standpoint, the Second World War consisted of three organically separable wars. The first of these was an intracultural war, England versus Germany. In the terminology of ideas, it was a war of capitalism versus socialism. But as these two great outlooks have an organic relation to each other, it was actually a struggle between the past and the future, for capitalism belongs to the past. Authoritarian ethical socialism to the future. Since the past can never overcome the fact of the future, except in semblance, this intracultural war had only two possible results: victory of the idea of ethical socialism, or chaos within the entire Western organism. The second of these wars began with the attack by the Provisional European Imperium on Russia, the leader of the Outer Revolt against Western rule. The natural organic form of this war would have been Europe with all its colonies, America, South Africa, Australia, Argentina et al., against Russia and the other Asiatic powers. Thus, it would have ended in the political destruction of the Asiatic powers, including Russia, and in the establishment of Western world rule in a stricter, more absolute form than the Western Empire, let us say, of 1900. The third of these wars was related to the second, the American War against Japan. Like the European War against Russia, was a war of the West against the Outer Revolt. In this war, America's role was that of a Western colony, and its victory over Japan was also a victory for Europe, just as a victory of Europe over Russia would have been a victory also for America. The first, the intra-European war, very quickly lost the character of such, since England's total war effort was brought ever more under the direction of the Washington regime. And England, likewise its remaining overseas possessions, was occupied by American troops. Thereby, the Washington regime wanted to ensure that England would not attempt to bail out of the war. With the American occupation of England and the remnants of its empire, the intra-European war of England versus Germany ended. From then on, there were two organically dissociated wars: Europe versus the American-Russian coalition, and Japan versus America. Wherever the English military forces fought on, it was only for the extension of Russian or American power, for now there was no longer an English political unit whose power could be extended by victory. Thus, America became involved in all three organically dissociated wars. Its participation in the Second World War was a struggle for the victory of the West in regard to Japan, and simultaneously for the defeat of the West in regard to Russia. America fought for an Asiatic victory and against an Asiatic victory. The outcome of the second organically dissociated war, that of the European Imperium versus Russia, was complicated by America's policy vis-à-vis Russia. At the beginning of the war, Russia was prepared to conclude peace with Europe, but the Washington regime, in accordance with its purely negative anti-American policy of defeating authoritarian socialist Europe at any cost, even that of national suicide, promised to give economic support to Russia's entire war effort so long as it would stay in the war, promised to share with it in a Russian-American world condominium in the post-war period. America's conduct vis-à-vis Russia has never had its like in world history. During the war, America deprived its own armed forces of huge masses of war material, which it delivered to Russia without charge and without any terms of repayment. Now, that's interesting, because we're used to thinking of them as the enemy, but America supplied Russia with 14,795 aircraft, 7,056 tanks, 51,503 jeeps, 35,170 motorcycles, 8,071 tractors, 375,883 lorries. It's like taxis, I guess. Other machinery valued at $1.078 million, 107 million yards of cotton products, and 62 million yards of woolen products. This listing is incomplete and does not include ships, foodstuffs, railway material, etc. At American orders, huge quantities of armaments and other vital equipment were withdrawn from the English army and delivered to Russia, including 5,031 tanks and 6,778 aircraft. Deliveries of raw materials reached the value of £39 million. The American Viceroy in England, Churchill, confessed in his memoirs that one of his diplomatic problems lay in persuading the Russians to accept these gifts without suspicion and with goodwill. Throughout the war, the communist underground movements the whole world over received from North America weapons, munitions, explosives, clothing, medicines, foodstuffs, and financial support. This in Europe, in Serbia, and in the Far East, especially Celebes, Sumatra, Indochina, and China. It is clear once again from the simple organic laws of politics that the Washington regime in no way pursued an American policy. A nationalist policy can never be negative. When a nation's policy becomes negative, something has prevailed over the national interest. All during the war, American propaganda was governed by a single great imperative: destroy Germany. In the background was the weak echo: destroy Japan. The propaganda left no doubt, however, about the relative importance of these two negatives. Without America's intervention as the all-sacrificing lackey of Russia, the war of Europe versus Russia could have ended in two ways: political destruction of Russia by Europe, or negotiated peace. After the American war entry, the second possibility was eliminated. In its main aspect, the Second World War was no longer a war of Europe against Russia, but a fortiori, a war of America against Europe, and this war had only one possible outcome: political destruction of Europe. The innumerable Russian troops fought practically under the same command as the troops of America and its satellites. Faced with this coalition of powers, the European Imperium had no choice but to sue for peace. The American formula of unconditional surrender made that impossible, however. The third of the organically dissociated wars, Japan versus America, had three possible results: political destruction of Japan, negotiated peace, or the expulsion of the American power from the Pacific. A political destruction of America was and is impossible owing to America's geographic breadth and position. Only America's overseas empire in the Mediterranean, in Africa, in the Persian Gulf, and in the Pacific, and in the Caribbean can be destroyed, not, however, the American political basis, autarkic and inaccessible as it is to large armies from another continent. Autarky, again, means that you're self-sufficient. You can produce everything you need to get by on your own, as opposed to being tied to others economically and necessarily. That ends the first chapter of the second section. The next chapter is Results of the War, page 29. After the American occupation of England, there was no longer a war between England and Germany, for the ability to wage war against an enemy of one's own choosing is the mark of a sovereign power, and England's sovereignty had ceased to exist. And he has an asterisk, CF Imperium, and yeah, he talks about that concept at great length. But there was still a spiritual, ethical, quote-unquote, war between the English idea of capitalism and the Prussian-German ideal or idea of ethical socialism. Since in this age of absolute politics, politics takes unto itself every aspect of life, this spiritual-ethical conflict had to be decided by the politico-military conflict. Thus, the 19th-century idea of capitalism won a pseudo-victory over the 20th-century idea of ethical socialism, and that meant chaos throughout the Western civilization. The past cannot win an enduring victory over the future. The later Stuarts and Bourbons learnt that, so did Metternich. It is an old lesson that must ever be learnt anew. In its spiritual-ethical aspect, the war, since it did not destroy Europe, came to its sole possible result. It weakened the idea of capitalism and, in the same tempo, strengthened the idea of socialism by giving socialism a victory, at least in the field of technics. After the war, the only possible way of governing and maintaining order in every Western country was through complete political regulation of economic life. In other words, through the application of socialist techniques. Everywhere, laissez-faire is dead, both nationally and internationally, except in the very highest economic sphere, that of bank and bourse. For the time being, that domain is spared state intervention simply because it is where the governments are chosen. Behind parliamentary puppets stands the master of money. The Second War, that of the provincial European Imperium against Russia, yielded military and political victory to Russia. That politico-military victory, based on American aid, given with the largesse unique in world history, made the Russian Empire into the world's foremost power, owing to its geopolitical position and to the poor quality of its only remaining opponent, notwithstanding that this opponent dominated a greater part of the planet than it did. Of course, remember, he's writing this, I think, in 52. England's pseudo-victory was owing solely to the Washington regime's policy of sacrificing American and European interests to Russian interests. It is a fact of great importance that the Washington regime, quite consciously and deliberately, created the present Russian Empire as an instrument of its absolute anti-German, anti-European policy. The Third War, that of America versus Japan, was, from a cultural standpoint, a war of Western civilization against the outer revolt. To superficial observers, its outcome seemed to be political annihilation of Japan. Yet this war ended in a negotiated peace. The most important fact about Japanese history, society, and politics is that Japan contains a nation-bearing stratum, a level of the population that feels itself charged with an organic mission. America did nothing to weaken this stratum's feelings of a mission. Through peace negotiations, the Japanese nation, state, aristocracy, and other institutions were preserved. The Japanese army was disbanded honorably, and the emperor, the Japanese national idea, suffered no Oriental loss of face. An American army occupied the island, and even the commander of that army spoke openly on behalf of an early termination of the occupation. This war resulted in a military and psychological victory for America, and at least for the moment, the West reasserted itself in a part of the world where it had been in retreat for 75 years. At the time, however, in Imperium, I called Japan a political victor of the Second World War because its outer mission, the expulsion of the West from Asia, had been accomplished, and its inner independence, though temporarily suspended, had not really been abolished. The Washington regime, which had but little interest in the matter of Japan, permitted its occupation forces considerably more autonomy. The leaders of those forces had no idea at all of the types of power and of the overcurrents of power in the world. Their notion of exploiting the victory was on the journalistic plane. They regarded the main effort of the occupation not as political, but as moral. In all seriousness, this leadership wanted to educate the Japanese nation as though it were a child and teach it, quote, democracy. The extent to which the military victory of America over Japan was also a political victory over Japan for the entire Western civilization is thus very slight indeed. The regime's policy of reconstructing Japan undermined the great part of the victory, or the greatest part of the victory. Its surrender of China and Manchuria to Russia, the leader of the outer revolt, Japan surrendered China and Manchuria to Russia, they are the leaders of the outer revolt against Western civilization, undermined it even further. The last remaining step, the restoration of Japanese sovereignty, is only a matter of time, for here the initiative lies with Japan. So long as the Japanese monarchy and the Japanese nation-bearing stratum, with its feeling of a mission, survive unimpaired, a revival of Japanese sovereignty, Japanese militarism, and the Japanese empire against America is certain. The outer revolt against the West was only locally contained by America's military victory over Japan. In other parts of the world, or in other parts of the Far East, the revolts were successful. The Chinese, Malays, Indonesians, and the primitive denizens of the Philippines expelled their Western masters. In the metapolitical sense, the Western civilization lost the war against Japan, despite the local, purely military victory of the Americans. Final chapter of the second section of four. The power problems of the war. The two great power currents in the world before the Second World War were the centrifugal flows of power from the Western organism to the outer forces, especially away from the continental European nations, since the obsolescence of the English national idea led to the power current England-America, and then the centripetal flow of the attributes that alone make power vital and lasting from England to Prussia-Germany, that is, the change in spirit from national economic to ethical socialism, he's saying. to set forth these two power currents as power problems from the European standpoint, the first problem was, how is European worldwide hegemony to be restored? And the second was, how is Europe to be imbued with ethical socialism, the only viable world outlook and nation-building force in this age of absolute politics? These two problems were the actual issues of the Second World War. Men and governments cannot create power problems. Rather, these arise when superpersonal organisms collide with existing power currents. Both lie far beyond any human control. In navigating the seas, one can sail with the currents or try to sail against them, but one cannot produce new currents. Thus it is with the organic. The possibilities are given and are not subject to alteration or dispute. One can either accept an organic possibility or abandon oneself to disappointment, disease, and chaos. If a possibility is frustrated long enough, it will one day no longer be there to accept, for the organic always has a duration of existence, that is, a lifespan. The more important of the two power problems in determining the form of the war was the first. The European Imperium voluntarily decided to give the problem of Europe's world position precedence over that of Europe's internal constitution. It was hoped that the solution of the latter problem could be postponed until a time when it could be resolved more easily and without endangering the European world position. The decision not to occupy the English island was the personal decision of the hero who was the custodian of the destiny of Europe during the Second World War. From the time of that decision on, from June 1941, the European Imperium's invasion of Asiatic Russia was the real war. Europe expended its energy mainly on winning that war, wherein a victory would have secured the destiny of the European culture for the coming century. Now the war could not take its natural course, that corresponding to the organic power problems, see England and Germany versus Russia and Japan, with America and the other colonies either neutral or allied to Europe. Instead, it was forced by the Washington regime into a distorted form. England and the European colonies attacked Europe from behind while it was struggling for its cultural, political, economic, social, military, technical survival. Since the form of the war was unnatural, having stood in no relation to the organic power problem posed by the power currents, its results were unnatural too. As the organic laws of politics show, such a distortion as the Second World War can result only from the intrusion of a culturally alien group into the political affairs of the host organism. The Second World War was the most monstrous manifestation of culture distortion in the history of high culture. The culturally alien group that conjured up the war could symbolize its triumph over the West through the infamous tribunal, quote-unquote, at Nuremberg. He always puts in quotes anything related to trials or law as it pertains to what happened after World War II to show that it was all fake and unreal and was using a form that it didn't actually contain the essence of. A year after the war, but its victory was as unnatural as the war itself. Nor can a culturally alien group occupy any kind of lasting political position within the host organism. It summons forth its own opposition, cultural antibodies, through which its power will eventually be dissolved. Power to be perfect must be openly exercised. However, a culturally alien group can hold power only so long as it works through others, through individuals, organizations, classes, governments, and groups of every sort that it manipulates to direct their forces temporarily into its own channels. Likewise, Russia's ascendancy as a result of the war is unnatural. It does not bring organic actualities to expression, but contradicts them. Europe possesses the true sources of power, which are spiritual, ethical. The Russian Empire is only a formless grouping of barbaric tribes with a purely negative mission. In this, its imperial age, Europe is simply not ripe for a long domination by barbarians. Thus, it was a war of spent energies and lost power, of territory lost and cities destroyed, a waste of life, wealth, effort, a waste everywhere but in the realm of heroism and the spirit. In the spiritual domain, the great process of forming the Imperium continued unrelentingly, and one saw the curious spectacle of the Washington regime's puppets, the Churchills, taking up the aim of the hero they had helped Washington and Moscow to destroy. They began to talk about the unification of Europe, in quotes. A few months before, they hated the Europe that had been united, indissolubly united through the blood spilt on the tundras and steppes. In the forests of Russia, and to destroy it, they were prepared to betray their European fatherlands and their own souls. After the war, the hottest-headed of the puppets shrieked in horror in the style of his war incitements that Asia now stood at the Elbe, that's the river in Germany, when the frontier was at the Volga and in the Caucasus, the mountains. He did everything in his power, little as that was, to bring this frontier into the middle of Europe. The heroic world stands infinitely above the economic, technical disjunction, util, inutile, useful, unuseful. Nor is the military test of victory valid in the realm of heroism. It was Cromwell who inspired generations of leaders long after his death and subsequent disgrace, not the later Stuarts, who had caused his body to be dismembered by wild horses. It was Napoleon who inspired a whole century of leaders after him, not Louis XVIII, nor Metternich, nor Talleyrand. About 1840, Napoleon triumphed. He whose name one could praise in Europe 20 years before only at one's peril. Napoleon's idea conquered the spiritual political realm, his personality the heroic realm. Who would reproach him now with the fact of the lost battles of Leipzig and Waterloo? So it shall be with the hero of the Second World War. He represented a new ethical type that will inspire and inwardly form all coming leaders of significance of the West. The bewailing of his mistakes, quote-unquote, after the Second World War was simply contemptible. Every journalist and every braggart knows better than the great man. They would not have made this mistake or that. Indeed, they would never have been in the place to do anything at all. Heroism is and can never be wasted. So long as men survive a hero, they will be influenced by him and his legend. He lives on in spirit and continues to act upon the world of facts and deeds. Thus ends the second of four sections of The Enemy of Europe by Francis Yockey. That will do for today. Thanks for listening. As always, you can find what we do at vnnforum.com. Everything we've recorded is there. And I'll be back with you again real soon.